Good morning. You've tuned into the International Connection, and today we're bringing you part two of an interview I've conducted with Valerie Wolf. Valerie's a therapist who has treated clients that are survivors of mind. She and two of her clients gave testimony of mind control experimentation to the Radiation Hearings Committee that took place in 1995 in the United States. Her clients have alleged that CIA doctors such as Martin Orne, Robert Heath, and Ewan Cameron had performed horrific experiments on them starting when they were children, including electroshock, sensory deprivation, drugs, and severe trauma, including physical, emotional, and sexual abuse. They claim this was done to control them to be used as sex slaves, intelligence operatives, and assassins. And now, the continuation of that interview with Valerie Wolf. After being exposed to the information about government mind control experimentation, how did you pursue finding more out about this?
Well, it's kind of like a double-edged sword for me, because what I started doing as I got information from people, I started sending it to people doing research like Alan Shefflin. I sent it to Alan Shefflin for verification because I had no idea what was going on. I had no idea who any of these people were, and they would call me back and say, Valerie, do you know who so-and-so is? And I'd have no clue who so-and-so is. And so it turned out to be people that were involved in this, and I had absolutely no idea, nor did my clients know. A lot of times the names would come out in really painful memories, but they really, I mean, I didn't know, and they didn't know. And so in order to do treatment, I don't need to know who was who and what they did and all that kind of stuff. I just passed that information on to Alan. I have not read in the area. My clients have not read in the area. I don't want to read because I don't want to know more than my clients do. I don't want to take a chance of cueing them or reacting to something. Now, of course, with some of my newer clients, I do know a lot, but my interest at this point is really in figuring out this treatment process and really figuring out how to get these people functional. That's where I really put all my energy. And as far as the details of it, I'm not that interested in. I mean, I guess I need to know some of it, especially local people, but I'm really not that interested in all that information, because it doesn't help in terms of therapy.
Right. But have you pursued getting more information about the experiments themselves and what was done, the particulars,
yeah,
as opposed
to...
That's more
useful information for me, is to know specifically what was done, and the kinds of things to expect and the kinds of techniques and that kind of stuff, because then I can interpret the metaphors, and that's what they talk about. Most of my clients do not, if they do know names, they're not telling me. They're not, I mean, I have a couple that do, and one that knows a lot, and it's, you know, and I mean, she was marvelous in the way that she made rhymes and all kinds of ways of remembering the information. I mean, she used the memory techniques they taught her to remember the information, and all kinds of limericks and rhymes and I forget what they're called, but you know, making words out of the names or whatever so that she could remember. I mean, it's absolutely fantastic. But most of my clients basically just want to survive day to day and get better and get on with their lives, so that they're, you know, they know Dr. Green. Everybody knows Dr. Green. That name comes up spontaneously. And when I get new clients that are mind control, I don't tell them what it is. I mean, basically what happens is a lot of times you get people, or I get people who they've had a lot of therapists. They have one therapist. They've been stuck for a very long time. They've done the family abuse. There may or may not be ritual abuse, like satanic ritual abuse or some other kind of sex ring type abuse. And they're stuck. And I hear things like, I'm afraid of doctors, or it's like I've had clients that get stuck on a memory for a year, 2 years, and they keep looping around this memory, but they never get to anything. And so then I, you know, there are certain things that I look for, and I can get into that. But what happens is I will begin to suspect it, start asking some really discreet questions, and then basically, if I become convinced that this has happened, what I say to people is, I think something else happened to you, for these reasons. These are the things you're saying. You've been stuck. There has to be something else. I have a fairly decent idea of what this might be, because usually there are clues. But what I'll do is I'll say, I can't tell you. Because you, and this is really true, you have to know that these are your memories and not something that I've suggested to you. Mm-hmm. Because if I start telling people about all the mind control stuff and start saying all this stuff, and then they get the memory, they're going to have a question as to whether it's what I told them, or because their hold on reality because of the experiments is tenuous sometimes, or not in terms of functioning, but in terms of knowing what's real and what's not. And so I don't, you know, and I just wait until it's time for the core birth personality to get the information. And it's fascinating to see however long it takes for that to come up, and they start talking about government-sponsored research, the CIA, the, you know, and it, I know that I have not told them this. Mm-hmm. And I know that they don't have access to information on this, because most of these people are not on the Internet. And if they are, they're certainly not in the mind-controlled areas. There's not a whole lot written on this, except in certain areas. They're not likely to go to a bookstore and get a book, and it's all in the alternative press. So, you know, I mean, they don't have access to the information. So when they recover or get that memory of what it really is about, they know that that's their memory and not something someone else has suggested. Because I'll ask that, too. What have you read? What have you read about memories? What do you know about memories from the media? And we'll talk about it.
Have you felt you've had to change your approach in terms of documenting what happens in your therapy session because of groups like the False Memory Syndrome Foundation?
No, because I've always been yes and no. I think I have to be more careful about, well, I guess rather than a client-centered process and talking about what the client's doing, I guess you have to add more about what you're doing now. It used to be the notes reflected what the clients were saying and what the clients were doing and the progress they were making, et cetera, et cetera. And now it's kind of shifted to where you have to talk about what you're doing as a therapist. So that's, I think, the major difference. I don't think it's all that bad.
How do you go about documenting that? Just through your therapy notes? Or?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah.
Have you ever felt that have you ever felt that you required to videotape a therapy session for whatever reason?
I had considered it, and I did it, thought about it, and actually, I have audio tape sessions, especially with clients that are being accessed. And that was very, very useful because it made me really conscious of what I was saying and doing. And so it was very useful from that standpoint. But as far as, I mean, admissibility, or if I ever got sued and it went to court, if someone's doing memories, because I listened to the tapes and I realized, if someone's doing memories, and this is one of the clients that was really abreacting and doing a great job, but when you hear, stop, please don't, on the tape, how do they know it is? No, it's a memory, and it isn't something I'm doing.
Mm.
Do you understand what I'm saying? You can't
yeah.
distinguish. Mm-hmm. And the other thing is I've talked to a number of people about it, and apparently in the court cases that have come, they've twisted stuff on the tape that was totally innocent. So basically my feeling is you give them more ammunition, not less, because they can always question. I mean, this is not a surgical process, you know, where you know where you're going to cut, you know what you're going to do, you know how much. I mean, there's just a lot of human interaction that goes on, and they can pick at anything. So I just don't think it doesn't really matter whether you videotape or audio tape or not. As I said, I found it really useful to do the audio tape just for me to make me conscious of what it was that I was doing in the session.
How do you feel about groups like the False Memory Syndrome Foundation with regards to their approach to this recovered memory debate?
My real honest to goodness feeling is that they've done us a favor. I think that they brought up some issues that were real issues that we needed to take a look at. I think people like me, when the McMartin case in California, you know, the preschool case where the McMartins were accused of ritual abuse, and that came up in the early 80s, 1984, I was at a conference and met all the people and heard the criticisms of Kee McFarlane. She did interviews according to what we did at that time. The prosecutors did not ask her to do forensic interviews. They did not train her in how to do that. She did essentially what we were doing and did a good job of it, and she got crucified. And light bulbs went off for those of us doing work at that time that had some experience, began to realize, you know, they're right. And so I began adjusting the way that I do things already since 1984, being more non-direct, being more non-leading, and actually it's better therapy. So I think the fact that they brought that up, and the fact that, in effect, a lot of research is being done on memory. I used to do talks on memory, you know, when I talk about sex abuse or child abuse and talk about testimony. One of the facts that I came across, and this is like in the early 90s, one of the facts that came across was that we were operating on memory research that had been done in 1911. That there really hadn't been a whole lot of new research on trauma memory. And so I think that they really pointed out a real gap in our knowledge. And and on the other hand, I also think it's a backlash, and it was inevitable. In the 80s, we really had our way in terms of child abuse and sex abuse and whatever, and I think a backlash was inevitable. And again, people who have a lot of experience, who've seen the cyclical nature of this, understand that this is going to happen. I think that part of the problem now is that we have really cleaned up our act. I mean, I do workshops and training, and I can hear more and more and more of it coming from therapists, being more careful, becoming better therapists, being more non-leading. But they're still riding the same horse. They're still accusing the same way. And then it makes me wonder, is there another agenda here? Because we are cleaning up our act.
And they're not acknowledging that?
No. And it's almost like they're saying, this research means nothing. You know, it means nothing. It's irrelevant. And it's totally relevant. And I think partly because a lot of the research is confirming what it is that we've known and what we've been saying.
Do you feel their early criticisms have, in a general sense, improved the quality of therapy?
Yeah, I do.
How do you think they've affected the access to therapy resources for survivors?
Yes, they have. Unfortunately, there are a lot of therapists that are real scared, that have dropped out, that don't want to do this kind of treatment anymore, and I think that's really sad. But I can understand that. I get scared sometimes. I've had two people who came to me by legitimate referral sources who all of a sudden, within a couple weeks, coming in for anxiety, depression, disorganization, that kind of stuff, within a couple of weeks, all of a sudden, I'm getting all these questions about multiple personality disorder, and it was sort of similar for both. all these questions about multiple personality disorder, and do you think maybe I could have that, bringing me in pictures, trying to trip me up in terms of interpreting the pictures. And I see the green triangle in the pictures, but I mean, again, but that's unusual. People do not come in question. Usually they come in, they're hiding everything from you, and it takes a year or two to even understand that there's something there that you need to be thinking about. But to come in within a couple of weeks and push and push and push and push. So with both of them, after a couple of weeks of that, I just said, all right, who do you have to talk to when you leave here? In one case, it was her father. In the other case, it was her uncle. And both these people recognized my name, and they had instructions to get me to diagnose them and to do this and to do that and to do the other thing. Hmm. And they were looking for a lawsuit. Well, that's scary. Mm-hmm. You know, I'm a pretty trusting soul. That's scary. So basically, what I had to do is I finished up the surface work that they came in for, because that was my therapy contract with them. But then basically, in terms of doing any kind of deeper work as far as abuse or anything else, it just wasn't safe for them or for me. And so and they agreed with that, and we ended up terminating therapy. But you know, so I never know when someone walks in my office if they're a client, and other therapists have reported the same stuff. So I never know. So it's a risk every time I take a new client. And that's terrible. That's terrible. I also know that some of my clients have been being accessed at times by their former perpetrators. And that's real scary, too, because there have been real attempts to get them to turn on me, to convince them that I've abused them or that I don't care or this or that or the other thing. And I can tell by their behavior if there's been access, you know, because they become really angry with me and disconnect, and I haven't done anything, you know. But
I've read of survivor accounts of that being programmed initially to throw the therapist off. Yes. With whatever.
Lots of therapist programming.
Have you
but
heard?
But regular, normal therapist programming, if you could call it that, that was put in place a long time ago is easy to deal with once you know what it is. Basically, I mean, it's what'll happen is, and this is how I figured out one of my clients was mind control. I had no idea. And believe me, I do not look for this. I do not look for this. It upsets me a lot when I realize that that's what I'm dealing with. In fact, I have a colleague that I talk to who's kind of followed my journey here, and I'll talk to him about a client, and he'll say, you know, Valerie, you're talking about this person just like how you talk when you don't want to deal with the fact that they're mind control. And because it upsets me when I find another one. You know, I'd much rather just deal with normal, regular, you know, it because of the pain involved. I mean, I really, and it is so hard to know that here's somebody else.
How many mind control survivors have you dealt with over the years?
Huh?
How many mind control survivors have you dealt with?
I deliberately haven't counted. I deliberately don't know how many I have in my caseload right now, because what has happened in the past is when they've accessed clients, I have known, and basically they start trying to figure out who they are. Mm. And if they know a number, they can start trying to figure out who they are, and I really don't want them to know. So I have come into contact with people. I can think of people that I've treated in the past before I knew this that were probably mind control. That I had no idea. I can think of, you know, so I just really deliberately don't know the answer to that question, because I don't want to. Plus, I have a contact with a lot of people across the country who call me or, you know, just in different ways. I have colleagues now who are consulting with me about clients who are mind control, because I do workshops and training, and then they'll realize, and then, you know, so I have a couple people that are learning how to do this. So I've come into contact with a lot, probably hundreds of people in terms of direct treatment. As I said, I deliberately don't know, because I was thinking before I talked to you on the phone, should I sit down and count up how many people, and then I decided no. I really don't want to know that.
Just to go back about the recovered memory debate, how prevalent currently do you think false memory implantation by the therapist is going on?
I have come across in clients several examples of really bad therapy. I have come across, I have been involved because I treat parents as well as survivors. I mean, and that has been real important for me to do, is to understand the offenders or the non-offending parent, how the family died, because it really is a family problem. And I really needed to know how perpetrators think and in order to better serve survivors and vice versa. I guess I have treated several people that I really did think that the therapist was pushing abuse that wasn't there. And again, by listening through what the therapist was saying, the client was saying, and listening to what the person, the father or the mother, what the parents were saying, and then when the therapist says to me, and I'll say, is this a direct, and she says, the client isn't sure, and I'll say, well, what are you, you seem certain, what are you basing it on? And she'll say, well, she has all these dreams. Well, dreams don't make for memories. Dreams are symbolic. And then, you know, so, and then I have, so that's one scenario that I've run into a couple of times. And then another scenario I've run into is with the mind control people, where people who've been ritually abused, and they don't know about the mind control, or think they've been only ritually abused, often tend to go to Christian counselors. And not all, but sometimes, and I can think of two in this city, really get into their own agendas and are very suggestible. I mean, one woman came to me, and her therapist had basically seen her for 5 years. And what she would do for the last three is she would have her sit in a chair, close her eyes, and she'd say, imagine the snakes. Think about, this is the therapist. Think about the snakes, or think about this, or get an image of Satan. And she did a lot of damage, because what happened was when this client finally got out of therapy with her, because she realized and was referred to me, a lot of our early work together was in separating out what was suggested by this therapist and what was real true memory. And but what I have discovered, and this is, I've had several clients like this, what I've discovered is they do know the difference. They do know the difference between what's planted or suggested and what's real. If you give them the chance to distinguish, they do know the difference. At least clinically, that's my experience. Because in the mind control stuff, there was a lot of research and a lot of attempt to plant false memories. Right. And again, there, they do know the difference.
Yeah, I'd like to talk about that in more detail a bit later on. I'd just like to shift the topic a little bit. You gave testimony at the radiation hearings in 1995.
Yeah.
President Clinton struck an advisory committee to look into the radiation experiments done on humans.
Yeah.
How did you become involved in that?
I think the way that I was asked was, there was a client in New Mexico that they had radiation hearings in her area, and she went and requested to testify because she remembered, she was mind control, but she remembered radiation stuff. So the guy who was setting up the committee and getting people to testify, Wally Cummings, became interested been getting, because it appeared that there was some crossover between the radiation and the mind control subjects. And World News, U.S. World News, no, World News and World Report, I forget anyway, U.S. News and World Report had written an article basically saying that there were four areas of human experimentation: mind control, radiation, drugs, and chemicals, chemical warfare. And basically, and they used human subjects, unwitting human subjects. And so they became interested in some of the potential overlaps. So he started making inquiries about people to testify to bring this information before the committee. They were also looking for documentation to do with radiation. And my name came up, and my two clients, because I've been sending all the stuff, you know, trying to verify and trying to validate what my clients were saying, and I'd done it in a very careful, meticulous way, plus the fact that I really was not reading, you know, all that stuff. So he called and asked, would I do it? And with my two clients, and invited my two clients. And so I talked to them, and they both agreed. And then, this is 2 weeks before, and I was taking my son to see colleges. So what I decided, I mean, I was on the road. I was on vacation. Mm-hmm. And what I decided to do is, rather than just go testify with these two clients, I decided that it would be, because we could send any documents ahead of time that we wanted to the committee, commission. I mean, we could send anything we wanted. So I decided to ask if people would send me a statement from either therapists or clients, basically to send to the Radiation Commission, a short statement to basically back up what we were talking about. And so things just poured in. Now, this is a week and a half before that we left. Mm. I mean, I had like 2 weeks to do this. So things just poured in, faxes and mail. I mean, I literally almost didn't sleep for a week because I had to make copies of everything. And, you know, one of the things I had to be careful about was to eliminate people's names, you know, because that's all in the fax. Because they wanted to be anonymous, or I didn't want their numbers going out, you know, because I knew it was going to be public record. And so I assembled, I guess it's about 20 statements, and sent it with our written testimony. And we were allowed to do long statements, although we could only talk for 5 minutes. And I got Colin Ross wrote something, and Alan Shefflin wrote something backing us up, and sent it all on to the Radiation Commission. And then we went and we testified, and that's kind of how it all came about. And that's why people think, I mean, that's why I needed the stuff within that week and a half. People still send me stuff, but I can't do anything with it. I'm not doing research, you know. And it's all, I think, from that. It never got erased from the Internet that I really didn't need stuff anymore.
And can you give us a sense of what you think the response of the committee members at the time of giving the testimony, what their response was to this information?
Well, it was interesting. We really grabbed them. I started, gave the overview, made some of the connections, and I'm used to public speaking. And as I started to speak, there was a member of the commission who turned to his neighbor and said, "What is this doing here?" Not loudly, but it wasn't "What is this?" It was "What is this doing here?"
Indicating.
And I got mad because I didn't want him disrupting us, and so I just projected. And his neighbor shushed him because she wanted to hear us, and then, you know, Claudia and Chris testified and did a really great job. I mean, people were very moved.
You are listening to an interview with Valerie Wolf, and we'll bring you the rest of that just right after this.